My name's Mackenzie, and I started a GoFundMe for the adoptive mother of a nonverbal autistic child. The mother had lost her job because she wasn't able to find adequate care for this autistic child. So she really needed some help with living expenses, paying some back bills. So I launched a GoFundMe to help support them during this crisis. And we raised about $10,000 within just a couple of months. I think that the surprising thing was by telling a clear story and just like really being very clear about what we needed, we had some really generous donations from people who were really moved by the situation that this family was struggling with.
GoFundMe is the world's number one fundraising platform trusted by over 200 million people. Start your GoFundMe today at GoFundMe.com. That's GoFundMe.com. GoFundMe.com. This podcast is supported by GoFundMe.
It's The Wonky Show. UCL settles and the lawyers are coming for 36 more universities. We'll think through the upshots. Home PGRs don't feel they belong, but international students do. What's going on there? And should your vice chancellor be moonlighting as a town planner? It's all coming up.
Is banks calling in their loans? Are institutions breaking their covenants? What is the risk appetite of institutions? Well, it's what the insurance market will support. And whether we like it or not, that is the underpinning regulatory imperative. It is fine if the OFS wants to tell you off. If you go bankrupt due to these massive financial institutions not supporting your level of risk, then it's all for naught anyway. It doesn't matter.
Welcome back to The Wonky Show, your weekly way into this week's higher education news, policy and analysis. I'm your host, Jim Dickinson, and here to help us get on top, across and underneath this week's HE news, as usual, three excellent guests. In Guildford, Rachel Brooks is Professor of Higher Education at the University of Oxford. Rachel, your highlight of the week, please.
It's probably what we were just having an informal chat about. I live, as you were saying, in Guildford, and the University of Surrey is converting their staff club into a Wetherspoons pub, and there's also one in Guildford Town Centre, so young people will be spoilt for choice, I think.
How exciting, a Spoons on campus. In Edinburgh this week, James Dunphy is Chief Exec at the Committee of University Chairs. James, your highlight of the week, please.
Good morning, colleagues. I met yesterday with the team who are authoring our new Code of HE Governance. They're in the thick of taking all the evidence they've received, and I know they're working hard to deliver, not just for CUC, but for our sector. No pressure, team. More power to your elbow.
And in Darlington this week, James Coe is Associate Editor at Wonky. James, your highlight of the week, please.
Hello, listeners. My highlight of the week, on a professional level, we have launched the Commission on Research for Better Economic Growth, which you can see on the site and write in to tell us all the ways research can grow the economy. On a personal level, Eddie Howe's beautiful Newcastle United won 6-1 in the Champions League.
This means nothing to me, Anna. So, yes, we start this week with student compensation. UCL has settled its bit of the student group claim, and Jimbo, it's not really a bit, is it?
No. Well, I suppose that depends how much you think £21.25 million is, Jim. So, should universities give students the things they believe they are getting when they sign up to a contract? Yes, we can all agree on that. To what extent should you be allowed to vary that when there are things like a global pandemic or industrial action? Well, that is the heart of the debate that's going on with the so-called student group claim, which, as you may be aware, is the legal claim brought by two law firms on behalf of former students affected by pandemic-era teaching. Now, the challenge has been to UCL this week, not because UCL are particularly bad or so particularly unusual, but as a test case. There has been an out-of-court settlement where there is no acknowledgement of fault, but to effectively expedite the process. I think it brings up a few interesting things. Is this going to be the start of a snowball of where we'll see these claims go more and more and more? Is it reasonable for universities to have done significant variations in a life, once-in-a-lifetime event? Or ultimately, is this going to be a start of reframing student power? But I suppose, worst of all, we might never know. The nature of out-of-court settlements is the details are pretty sketchy. So that's where we are, and I think there's a lot to go on.
Well, fascinating. This has been all over the news this week. Let's hear a clip.
9K for what? Someone protests in this student halls of residence. It was autumn 2020. Restrictions had tightened yet again. Students here in lockdown venting their frustration as again a rapid retreat to remote learning kicked in. The price paid for tuition versus the experience received could now be the subject of multiple claims against 36 universities in England and Wales.
The basis for the claims is very simple. During the pandemic, students had paid for in-person teaching and access to university facilities and were not given that. They were given online teaching, and libraries and other facilities were very often closed. When you pay for one thing and you receive something else, which is less valuable, then under English law, you're entitled to compensation.
Georgia Johnson is among the claimants. She was on a teacher training course at the University of Manchester.
The lectures, the seminars, that was all over Zoom. So, you know, when you go into a breakout room and no one talks, that's what it was. So I was adding as much as I could during learning time, but really I wasn't getting that practical practice, I guess, and also wasn't getting that discussion time with my peers, because it's very easy to just mute yourself and say, I'm not going to do it.
Well, this is fascinating. Rachel, the FT reports that the total settlement at UCL is 21.25 million for about, you know, just over 5,000 claimants, 35% going to the lawyers. Is this students getting a fair deal, or is it, you know, a big payday for the legal profession?
Well, it sounds quite like the latter, and I'd be interested to read more about it, about kind of, you know, what is actually the relationship between the students and the law firm. And I was reading this morning that since the settlement, and the lawyers have said that they're going to be going after other universities, many more students have joined the bandwagon. So I think that relationship is quite interesting. I suppose for me, it kind of, you know, raises broader questions about kind of how students do actually see higher education. Is it now kind of, you know, eroding further any sense of kind of, you know, higher education as a public good? Do they see it in kind of, you know, very strict kind of contractual terms, just being a kind of consumer buying a product? Or is this just kind of, you know, a mechanism to get a bit more kind of money in a situation where, you know, students don't have much and the cost of living is incredibly high? So I think it does raise broader questions for the sector and for how we think about higher education. And yeah, the role of law firms in this seems a bit problematic to me.
Yes, interesting. You know, it has this fundamentally changed, or is this a signal that the relationship has fundamentally changed? James, I guess, you know, UCL's statement talks about resolving things amicably without further expense. But, you know, from a governance perspective, what on earth will the other 36 universities be thinking right now?
I mean, clearly it's a case which will continue in the media, and there's no interest in the legal firm, presumably, in doing anything other than being able to pursue those other institutions. I mean, moving away a bit from the case, when I was a director of learning and teaching at a university when COVID hit, and I can really say at that point in time, you know, we were taking really urgent decisions to try to protect the quality of the student experience. I remember, for example, sending the digital team home before anybody else went off the campus to help them get ready for the massive upsurge in the use of the digital estate. When I was at the Funding Council in Scotland, one of our key concerns was to make sure students could graduate. And I think the fact that the vast majority of students through the COVID pandemic did have the ability to continue to have access to learning, had the ability to continue to be assessed, and as a result of that, were able to graduate on time, is a testament not just to the commitment and creativity of staff working in the system, but also to the really hard work that happened in government and regulatory partners too. But for sure, Jim, it will rumble on.
Yes, fascinating. I mean, part of it, Jimbo, is that obviously in the early bit of the pandemic, even the government itself was saying that universities can probably rely on these, you know, force majeure clauses. This is a once in a lifetime thing that's happened. You know, no one could have predicted it. It's an act of God. But actually, by the time we got to September, you'd got the OIA, OFS, all sorts of people saying, no, you can't rely on those clauses. You've got to tell students what's changed and get their consent. And it starts to look, I think, like lots of the sector didn't do that.
I was, when COVID was kicking off, Jim, I was working at university at the time, and my overriding memory is just the sheer volume of things to deal with, the entire lack of clarity and the chaos that was kicking around it. And there is always a risk that we look back onto the past with the information we have today and think about, well, what should we have done knowing that? I think the real fundamental problem here is the way in which it's a regulation problem, I think, right? So What we have is a very complex debate about a regulation of terms against a once-in-a-lifetime event and were students given what they were promised, basically. The problem is that there is a regulator that exists in order to enforce that. That happens in England, as is the case. What we have now is students effectively seeking contractual redress against what is a regulatory challenge. So I think the worst outcome of all of this is we end up learning absolutely nothing about how we might regulate for when there is massive unforeseen events that impact students' contractual terms and their rights. Universities learn nothing about what they may do differently, how they may be supported, what the expectations are from a morass of regulators who, you know, had their own challenges during this period. And worst of all, effectively, the students that end up with compensation are the ones who can access sort of legal advice for whatever reason. So my concern all of this is basically we learn nothing. The people who could get compensation don't. And as a regulated sector gets no better. So this will simply happen again. I can't really see this being a good outcome for anybody in the long term.
Yes, I mean, Rachel, where are you on this? I mean, part of it, I think, is, you know, I mean, if I look back, and I did do a little bit of looking back the other day, it looks like, the various regulators, particularly OFS, were effectively kind of covering their backside by saying, you've got to offer absolute clarity to students about what they can expect in the new year. And of course, then actually the national guidelines were, you know, actually only came out for higher education, I think, in mid-September. But, you know, the regulators were covering their backside and saying, look, contractually, you're going to have to tell people exactly what they can expect. Then, of course, that was fairly impossible. You know, where does blame lie here, do you think?
I mean, I think just sort of echoing what others have already said, and I do think, you know, my experience of working in a university at that time was that universities were trying to do their best in really difficult circumstances. And it seems to me a little bit unfair that they're being blamed for that when, as has just been said, there were a requirement from the government at the start about kind of, you know, not having people on campus and you know, and both students and staff having quite a lot of kind of, you know, difficult personal issues in their different circumstances that universities had to deal with. So to me, it does feel wrong to blame universities because I think there were lots of challenges for them and they tried very hard in difficult circumstances. And I think one of the kind of ironies is perhaps also that since the pandemic and even now, I think, you know, many universities do have problems getting students onto campus. And in many ways, there's kind of, you know, a real like of online learning and some apparent resistance to being on campus. So I do think that kind of, you know, gives a slight nuance to the debate too. But basically, yeah, I suppose in summary, it feels to me wrong to blame universities when they were trying hard in very difficult circumstances.
I mean, just to Rachel's point, Jim, the thing that I think I found most maddening about this debate is if you read some of the coverage, you would almost think the debate was, were students taught online or not? Yes, of course they were. There is no debate over students who thought they'd get taught in person were then taught online. The thing that I'd like to see is students who have entitlement to compensation because there is a genuine breach of their terms obviously should be entitled to it. Universities who had an enormous amount of responsibilities should be supported to learn from that. But we're going to end up in this absolutely absurd situation where universities aren't supported to think about what is the best version of terms and conditions in order to get the balance right between regulatory and legal responsibilities and students' rights. And students will nonetheless still feel shortchanged. Like there is no sort of grand good outcome for the sector as a whole in this.
The thing is though, James, right? If it was the case that this is, you know, overall pretty unfair on universities were doing their best and so on, presumably UCL wouldn't have settled.
So that's a question for UCL, Jim, not for me. But what I would say to add to Rachel's point, because I do think this is critical. So it wasn't the case that during the remainder of that academic year and then into the new one, that universities only delivered what they were going to deliver, but did it online. They also pivoted in a whole range of other ways. So for example, they stood up new student support services. They stood up new engagement with students. They worked really hard to pivot, not just from physical to digital, but also to change the service provision to make sure that students who were having really acutely difficult times, often not getting the experience they thought they would get. That's just the fact of it, right? That's the fact for many students in the system at that time. But making sure they were getting support that was contextualised to their needs. That includes, you know, support for students who were in distress through to, for example, different types of support to help students to study well while studying at home. So I think it'd be a mistake to accept the premise that because physical in-person teaching wasn't there, that there was no commitment from institutions to protect student wellbeing and protect student interests, and indeed to protect quality.
But this is the kernel of it, I think, isn't it, Rachel? Which I was actually looking back at some of the stuff I was writing at the time. And one of the things I said at one point was, and this really wound a lot of people up, I guess for obvious reasons, was, you know, sometimes when everyone has done their absolute level best, contractually, it's still not enough. And when it's not enough, should they have still paid the same amount?
I mean, I think, you know, that relates to kind of the broader financing of our higher education system. And, you know, it's not that universities have any excess money to pay this kind of amount. So I guess, you know, I think, you know, thinking about it, I suppose from a university's perspective, as James was just saying, I think, you know, they did the best in difficult circumstances. And I think, you know, perhaps there's just a lack of clarity that, you know, if universities have to respond to vet events that they have absolutely no control over, and they're being asked to do something specific by the government, to what extent do they have to pick up financial responsibility for that? And I guess, you know, there's also a kind of broader question of, you know, if they are settling large amounts of money, where who is actually paying for that with tight university budgets? Presumably, ultimately, it's either insurance companies, which will have implications with higher premiums in the future, or it's future students themselves, you know, who are paying for the amounts going out now. So for me, yeah, it seems a kind of, you know, unfair situation for universities to be placed in. I mean, I think, you know, nobody would disagree that students themselves had a really tough time in that period. But I think, you know, it wasn't that universities kind of exploited that situation for their own advantage at all, really. I think, you know, there was a genuine commitment to try to make things better for students and also for staff in very difficult circumstances.
I mean, I remember reading, I was working at university when you were writing some of the stuff, Jim, and I'd open it and I'd think, but this is just really hard. Like, regardless of what Jim's saying, you're simply going to drive me mad at the end of going through it, right? But I think this is the problem, that the terrain of the debate feels entirely wrong to me. There's a debate about, did students get what they said they would? There's a debate about, are experiences comparable? Well, no, of course they're not. Like, one year's experience to another is never comparable, regardless of global pandemics or not. The real crux of the debate is the extent to which universities are able to deviate on their terms, and the extent to which the ways their terms are constructed allow them to do so. That is a massive and interesting and important regulatory debate about the entire sector that I fear we're just simply never going to have. So all that means is that we'll have a version of this basically forever on a larger scale or smaller scale from time to time.
Well, you say that, James, but I mean, you know, one of the really interesting things, I think, if I look through the, you know, the terms that were in play, and we kind of know that from some of the documents that went to previous hearings when they were trying to work out whether you can do it as a, you know, a big group or not. If you look at some of those terms, you know, Competition and Markets Authority has been really clear about some of those. You know, the classic, if we're not looking at the pandemic, is, can you say in your terms that you can't be held responsible for industrial action of your own staff? Now, you've got a regulator on the one hand who's been saying that since 2015. lots of universities still saying, actually, we can't be held responsible for that. You know, you can't tell Joe Grady what to do nationally. And you've got this kind of weird standoff. So presumably at some point, the CMA and or OFS or someone is going to turn around and say, we do have to clear this up.
No doubt there are lessons for regulators as much as there are for government in the handling of the pandemic. I mean, I moved from an institution into a regulator midway through the pandemic, having just delivered the online welcome for students who were joining the university I was exiting. I think I would go back to the points made by Jim and by Rachel. Everyone working in the system at that point was committed to trying to deliver the level best they could. Actually, that often meant making personal sacrifice. And as Rachel mentioned herself, you know, in situations which were far from ideal for those staff members, I think drawing the learning from it is really important. Also celebrating where there are positives, the positives. I mean, in many institutions, there were real step changes in the use of digital learning systems, sometimes digital learning systems that had been there for a long time but hadn't really come into mainstream use. But as James says, really reflecting on some of that learning and thinking about how we can use it positively into the future feels like the right judgment to me.
But just on that, James, JD, let's imagine that it's the case that students, you know, for all sorts of, you know, complex legal reasons, weren't really due to pay the amount that perhaps their predecessors had paid. And it was the case that universities were, you know, pulling miracles to put on what they were putting on. That's an argument for government stepping in, isn't it? Rather than just maintaining the high fee that students were charged.
So there was government support in different parts of the system, and indeed regulators introduced flexibilities throughout the pandemic to help providers to manage what they were managing. That would be different in different of the UK nations, but certainly in Scotland, the Scottish government applied additional resource into the budget of SFC, and we did everything that we could in that time to make sure that we supported institutions, both through flexibilities in our funding and regulatory expectations, and in terms of direct application of cash into the system. I think that comes to that point. You know, we are in a system. We do have responsibilities at institutional level, but of course we also in that complex system of responsibilities at government and regulatory space too.
I mean, that year was interesting financially, Rachel, because, you know, at the start of that year, there was panic that students weren't going to come in September. You know, there would be, you know, the sector was, you know, going to collapse. And then actually, if you look at the accounts for that year, because people weren't, you know, weren't turning the lights on or the heating on and furlough money was coming in, universities had a bumper year.
So, well, I haven't read those accounts, but I think, you know, that kind of financial bumper year that you've just mentioned certainly hasn't kind of continued now. And I think, you know, certainly at the university I was working at the time, it didn't feel like that, and it wasn't the case, because I think they'd lost a lot of money on student accommodation that, you know, students weren't using. And I think, you know, many universities, that was actually kind of one of the drivers to get students back onto campus, the kind of financial losses that they had sustained through accommodation not being used and therefore not being paid for. So I think, you know, there's complexity around that. I don't think that kind of bumper year was probably the case for all universities by any stretch of the imagination. And I mean, I guess there's the point about kind of, you know, the regulatory issues that we were just talking about. But I think, you know, to me, there are kind of broader moral issues here that, you know, universities, you know, were struggling to kind of, you know, provide the best service they could to students in a very difficult situation. And I think, you know, beyond the kind of, you know, the time commitment of staff, and actually it's probably worth saying in terms of kind of, you know, cost to universities, I think staff were putting in many more hours than they would have done with face-to-face teaching because of kind of the adaptation to new technology and the preparation for, you know, teaching in a very different way through online learning. So the kind of staff costs went up, research was often kind of neglected for that reason. But, you know, that kind of the I suppose the kind of, yeah, the challenge, the financial challenges that, you know, followed quite closely on that do seem to me kind of, you know, put universities in a situation where to kind of financially penalize them now for doing their very best kind of morally in a very difficult situation seems pretty problematic.
But I also, just to bluntly agree with Rachel, government isn't going to step in under any circumstance in order to provide compensation, because in doing so, you would effectively go back on everybody who has a risk of their contractual rights being broken through COVID, and it would become enormously expensive, basically forever. I think one of the risks that Rachel's points highlights is effectively you could end up with the wealthiest institutions who have the headroom to settle in some of these instances, and those who don't not doing so, and end up having the public debate effectively on behalf of the sector. Like, this is why it's a fundamental sector-wide problem that's only going to lead to partial redress through this kind of action.
Yes, although, you know, at the time, people who'd booked a holiday, people who'd got a contract with their local nursery, people who'd booked a wedding, they were all routinely getting compensation or discounts and so on. You know, the fact that this wasn't handled at the time might make it more unique than it feels, I guess. But I mean, on that, Jimbo, right? It on the assumption that some proportion or other of either the UCL case or any of the other cases are going to be covered by insurers, I guess the question that comes up is, if you're a student that makes a complaint and you're expecting that complaint to be handled without bias, according to, you know, the OIA, if your insurer is really kind of, you know, calling the shots, trying to limit the liability, that's not really being handled in an unbiased way, is it?
Well, I think there's two things there, right? I think the challenge with your example, Jim, is that it would again depend on the contractual right. So if I think of my daughter's nursery, where, you know, I would say I pay almost all my wages to send her, fine, not that I'm extremely bitter about this. The thing that I am regularly told I pay for is to guarantee her place, not for whether she's available to go to nursery or not. So if she was to get a flu and be sick for 2 weeks, I can't get my money back. A holiday is a guaranteed period of time. The problem with all of this is that higher education is more intangible in lots of ways. It's really, really hard to do that. On the insurer's point, right, is this not a really interesting debate over who is actually calling the shots in higher education? Well, if you look at sort of...
Hence the title of my blog this week.
Well, yes, and Jim Mercer, what a blog. You know, go and read it, everyone. But if you look at like the financial debate, right, what is the actual risk to financial stability of the sector? It's banks calling in their loans or institutions breaking their covenants. What is the risk appetite of institutions? Well, it's what the insurance market will support. And whether we like it or not, that is the underpinning regulatory imperative. It is fine if the OFS wants to tell you off. If you go bankrupt due to these massive financial institutions not supporting your level of risk, then it's all for naught anyway. It doesn't matter.
But I mean, JD, doesn't that then create this bizarre scenario where the official message to students is, you know, a complaint that you make about the university will be handled with, you know, without bias and, you know, on its merits? And really what's happening is, you know, it'll be handled in accordance with the risk profile of your insurer.
So, Jim, before I go on to that, I want to just go back to that point around weddings and holidays and things like that. So clearly there was loads of disruption in people's lives, including to things like holidays and weddings. Fundamentally, it is my understanding that most institutions continued to award credit and therefore continued to award degrees and qualifications during that period. So I think what we're talking here about is a disruption to the type of experience that students expected to get or were promised to get in the context of the engagement they had. But certainly, in most of the institutions that I am aware of through the pandemic, they continued through the work that we've talked about, including the pivot off campus, the change to student support services, to help students to learn and therefore to enable students to be assessed. And that means they were able to secure credit and also then graduate. That's not to look away from the different experiences, but it is quite different, I think, from saying a wedding was cancelled.
If I've booked a wedding and then the company goes, oh, well, the venue's not available anymore, you're not getting any food, all our chairs are broken, but I'm still going to make sure that by the end of it, you're married. That doesn't count. Obviously, you're paying for the experiences that facilitate the outcome. It's not, you're not only buying the outcome in a university, are you?
Yeah, for sure. And that's not the point I was making. My point was simply to point to that kind of very transactional nature of a commercial arrangement and the difference that exists between the compact that a university and a student form together. And actually, it's for the reason of that compact, I think, that institutions, those who work in them, work really hard to try to provide the best possible experience to students throughout the pandemic.
Anyway, on the insurance issue.
Universities are just more complicated than weddings as well, Jim. Like, that's surely the underlying principle. I mean, my own wedding venue.
I'm not sure they are. I mean, you know, if you think about the LLE, I've got a feeling that someone buying a 30-credit module is going to be less complicated than the average wedding.
What? It's miles more complicated. I mean, look, my own wedding venue went bust during COVID and I got paid out by my insurers. And basically their argument was, this isn't our fault. We can't control it, therefore X, Y, or Z. So I think there's a difference, right, of what is the product you are actually entitled to in higher education is the crux of this debate. And that's massively complicated to define as opposed to a wedding, which is, you know, go there early on, get married, have some drinks, have some food, go home, you sort of days done.
Okay. Look, here's my hypothesis, Rachel, right? All of this has been actually in place for a very long time. You know, that guidance from the Competition and Markets Authority came out in 2015. I guess one of the senses I've got is that people are just starting to understand the implications.
So, I mean, I think it does, as this discussion has kind of highlighted, I think it does raise really important issues for the sector. And if it has the effect of kind of, you know, forcing regulatory bodies or government to clarify kind of what expectations are and what the situation is, that is probably a good thing. But I do think it is kind of more complicated than that, because I do think in a positive way that the pandemic did also kind of, you know, give both staff and students exposure to new forms of learning. And so kind of we've been very critical, I suppose, of this discussion about kind of online learning. But I think, you know, there were quite positive message from that experience that actually students have wanted continued. So I mentioned earlier kind of, you know, attendance issues. And I think students, you know, have found kind of lots of kind of positives in recorded lectures, more things being done online than previously. And just it goes back to kind of James's point, I think, and Jim's about the kind of complexity of this and not comparing it to other consumer goods, that I think, you know, yes, learning undoubtedly did take place over that period. And even more so, I think, you know, it did kind of allow experimentation with perhaps new forms of pedagogy, which weren't entirely negative, and which students themselves, I think, have shown kind of, you know, through their attendance patterns that they do value on online learning in some ways and in some contexts. So I think it is kind of a more kind of complex picture than the coverage of this particular case probably indicates.
As ever. Well, great stuff. Plenty more on the site on all of this. For now, let's see who's been blogging for us this week.
Hi, I'm Farheen Akhtar, and this week on Wonky, I've been blogging about why improved data is essential to tackling current and future technical skills shortages. The way HESA data is reporting on technical staff is changing. In case you didn't know, from 2028, HESA is improving how technical professional data is captured and understood within the sector.
My name is Mackenzie, and I started a GoFundMe for the adoptive mother of a nonverbal autistic child. The mother had lost her job because she wasn't able to find adequate care for this autistic child. So she really needed some help with living expenses, paying some back bills. So I launched a GoFundMe to help support them during this crisis. And we raised about $10,000 within just a couple of months. I think that the surprising thing was by telling a clear story and just like really being very clear about what we needed, we had some really generous donations from people who were really moved by the situation that this family was struggling with.
GoFundMe is the world's number one fundraising platform, trusted by over 200 million people. Start your GoFundMe today at GoFundMe.com. That's GoFundMe.com. GoFundMe.com. This podcast is supported by GoFundMe.
Changes would enable earlier identification of emerging technical skills needs. This includes technical skills needed to deliver the UK's research and innovation ambitions. It would also enable effective policy responses across technical education, training, recruitment, and skills development. The sector is definitely moving in the right direction to enhance visibility and recognition for technical professionals.
Now, next up, the PRES is out. Rachel, what's going on?
Okay, so PRES, I've always called it PRES, but so this is the Postgraduate Research Experience survey that Advance HE have just published. This used to be conducted every 2 years. Now they do it every year, but because universities don't take part themselves every year, it's a little bit difficult to make comparisons from year to year. But overall, it's a good news story, I think. High levels of overall satisfaction from those who completed it, the PhD students. So the overall level of satisfaction, 83%, and this is the highest since 2011. And also rates of satisfaction are now quite similar between home students and international students. And there has been a gap previously, but that's been closing. Less positively, disabled students seem less satisfied than other students. There's an 11-point gap there, which seems quite significant. And although the overall levels of satisfaction between home and international students have closed, there are also some interesting differences there, with really surprisingly to me, international students feeling much a stronger sense of belonging than home students. And I think that raises some interesting questions. So that's one of the findings that was particularly interesting to me. And I think kind of probably highlights some challenges for the sector in terms of how to increase home students' sense of kind of community and belonging too.
Well, fascinating. Now, James, JD, you know, generally this looks like really good news by the looks of it. But we do have to, you've got this similar problem that we have with the NSS, haven't we? Which is there's a danger that the headline number reflects the percentage of your students that are international rather than actual satisfaction.
Well, can I start by giving a shout out to Jonathan Neves at Advanced HE? He has, for a number of years, worked really hard to deliver this survey and other surveys that Advanced HE puts out. And I think it's really important, particularly at a time of transformation in the system, when we know higher education is going through a whole range of changes, that we get really good evidence of the student experience. I think the thing that came out from me here was that link between belonging and student satisfaction. And that for me reminds us that in the world that is rich in technology, creating strong engagement between educators and students, among students, is really important in creating really good student experiences. I think we should be really alert to the experience of disabled students. There is much more work for us to do to make our brilliant higher education more accessible and more relatable for different students. You know, this survey helps us to remember that, but so too does the work that we need to do to close the attainment gap for Black students. It is possible, I would suggest, for us to be really proud of the progress that we are making, but also still to want to go further to make higher education more accessible for all.
Hmm. Jimbo, this thing about teaching, you know, one of the things I think I've picked up over the last couple of years with all the, you know, the cuts and so on, is that actually in some universities, PGRs that teach, you know, is on the increase because, you know, core members of academic staff have been lost. And in some places, the diametric opposite has happened in order to save on money. But it's not just about the opportunity to teach, is it? I mean, last week I was reading a policy that said, I'm not making this up, this is an actual policy from a UK university. You'll only be offered training on how to deliver teaching when you've done 20 hours of teaching, which did strike me as being a bit like, you know, only offering people a driving lesson if they've had a go at the wheel.
I'm going to teach you manual handling after you've picked up all the heavy boxes. Next. So, Jim, I am the wrong person to ask about satisfaction. I can't get no satisfaction in any sense. But what I think your point illustrates is we sort of struggle to know what to do with this group of students. I did some work a couple of years ago about the non-economic impacts of international PGR students to the UK sort of higher education learning base. And a few things really stick out for me. They are our single best knowledge asset in lots of cases. We don't really think very carefully about how could we cultivate that? How do we support, you know, things like belonging contributes to getting the most out of their contributions? How does working between international students and home students increase our overall knowledge? And I think that seems a shame. We get stuck in these ever more interesting debates about whether these are students, are they workers, what does that mean for satisfaction? In reality, people just want to be treated decently and feel like they're getting a fair shout, regardless of where they're at. And I suppose in a bit, I've been doing some work with the University of York, University of Sheffield and others through the Research Supervisory Project, RSVP. And it really strikes me to your point, the fact that there is not enough recognition of what does good supervision look like? What does good support look like? What could be a model that we do elsewhere? Does it have to be this weird one-to-one or two-to-one thing that we've had forever? Seems like an absolute missed opportunity. So the reason why I like the PRS, for all sort of the debate about it, it's one of the very few times where the fact we don't really think very hard about that experience actually gets a fair airing in any kind of way.
Yes. I mean, there's an aspect of that, I guess, Rachel, with this disabled students thing that really fascinates me. So I was on the launch of the Disabled Students UK thing the other week. You know, the big thing that was coming out there was this idea that students kind of agree their reasonable adjustments with the kind of disability function in the university, and then are struggling to get academics to sort of, you know, deliver those. But in this case, it looks like it's kind of worse than that, which is the disability function doesn't understand PGR to start with.
Yeah, I found that quite striking too, because it said that less than half of disabled PGRs agreed that their institution provides the reasonable adjustments that they need. And I think that does raise questions about what is going on there. And exactly. And I think so that probably needs digging into. And yeah, I haven't done that. And I don't know if the report actually says any more about that. But I think that's also kind of surprising, given that, you know, we're not talking about kind of, you know, people who are probably not new to the higher education system. So they'll have been precedents from their undergraduate experience. And I don't know also kind of, you know, whether that
that number kind of can be kind of disaggregated in terms of home international, whether actually, you know, you've got kind of, you know, people who are new to the UK and are therefore it's taking more time to sort out that kind of provision. So I think it does raise some questions, which I actually don't know the answer to at this point. But I think, you know, it's something that probably should be something that institutions reflect on and think about how their own practice does kind of, you know, feed into those kind of statistics.
This, James, this other thing on belonging, one of my reflections over the past few years, because lots of people have done work on belonging, we've done work on belonging, you know, lots of people have done work on belonging. My sense is that lots of people are in danger of, you know, kind of overcomplicating it, insofar as if I really boil down lots of the stuff that we've done with all sorts of different sorts of students, including PGRs, I might add, a lot of it is just they want some opportunities to spend some time with other students.
Yeah, absolutely. So I think there's a real human dimension, right, to this work. So one of my favourite references, and I'm sorry to drop this in, is Chickering and Gamson's Seven Principles for Good Practice in Undergraduate Education. I really would suggest listeners check it out. It was published in 1987. It's like one page, really easy to read. And it underlines, Jim, your point about getting this right matters to students. It also matters to educators and those who support learning. It is not rocket science to do, but it does take a bit of design work. And of course, then going back to the conversation we had around, you know, the experience through COVID, when you're trying to do it for 40,000 students in an institution, it takes a lot of work. It takes a lot of planning and it takes a bit of design work to really make sure you can deliver it at scale. And that includes, for example, the link between academic teams and those working in central support roles and disability roles or in library services. It definitely includes developing that reciprocity amongst the student community as well. But at its heart, it's fairly straightforward, right?
Jimbo, how much of this do you reckon is when, you know, when I was a student, when I was a PGR student, I had it rough and, you know, this is survival of the fittest and, you know, that, you know, this kind of Darwinian, this is how the system produces the, you know, it surfaces the best people. How much of it is never did me any harm?
Do you mean, is this the tyranny of nostalgia, proper bin men, things are better in my way, sort of era of PGR experience? So having done work in this area, I think it is almost exact. I think in lots of cases, it's almost the exact opposite, which is, I can't believe how terrible this was for me, and things continue to be very hard. There is clearly something structurally wrong. I think there's two problems there. Three actually. The regulatory sort of grasp around the PGR experience in order to think about what does this mean for provision, what does it mean for services, is clearly much more slight than we see about undergraduates. There is simply less attention paid to it at institution levels because it is fewer students, much harder circumstances. And I suppose the other way is when I think back to my student union sabbatical days all those years ago, I ran on small practical changes because I recognise the things that I think addresses some of the belonging, loneliness, PGR, PGT, UG, is things like, do I have somewhere nice to sit? Is it warm? Are there microwaves? Can I get a coffee before 9 o'clock? Like all of that, right? But it's quite hard to affect that on an institutional level. Like, weirdly, those sort of accumulation of things that overfilled the dustbin of a bad student experience are much harder to address than doing like a brand new PGR student experience strategy. So, you know, for anyone listening to this, that'd be what I'd think about. Stop worrying about our PGRs distinct as much, but what are the basic needs that help to build them a sense of community?
Jim, you're giving me flashbacks to once doing a series of student focus groups and going to a campus to ask about the experience of catering facilities, only to find after I'd done the focus group there weren't any catering facilities on that campus. So I think you're spot on, right? I think you're spot on. And those kind of tangible things really matter. And of course, for the PGR student experience, it's a much more personal experience to the individual. So, you know, having those links between your PGR community and decision makers, including decision makers in estates teams, in student finance teams, really matters. The other point I was just going to draw out in the report is the stuff around cost of living and the impact that is having on the student experience. Again, these are really tangible things that even if we can't resolve them, we can engage in conversation with our students. And through that conversation, we can understand the kind of tangible actions we can take to help make their experience more positive.
Yeah. I'll tell you what, I've got a question for you, Rachel, right? I guess of all the people that I might expect to have a kind of interesting view on this, which is, you know, this isn't just a transactional relationship. This is about relationships. This is about a community of staff and students and scholars and so on. If academic staff are having a fairly choppy or rough time, we might expect that to kind of rub off on PGRs more than we might undergrads, maybe.
Yes, I think we might do. And I think that's why, you know, the kind of overall high level of satisfaction is, you know, great and good, and probably shows that, you know, staff who've been in difficult circumstances, you know, have continued to do a great job with their students and not passed on any kind of, you know, unhappiness that they might have to that group. So I think that does kind of, you know, reflect well on how staff have operated under, you know, in many institutions, quite difficult circumstances. But I guess I just wanted to kind of go back to the point about kind of belonging as well. And I think the differences between international and home students. And I think perhaps going back to kind of, you know, the point about PGLs being a relatively small community, I guess a lot of work in many institutions has gone into kind of improving services for international students and thinking about what their specific needs are as a group. And I think devoting quite a lot of time and attention to that. And so I guess maybe some of the difference might be explained by, you know, the results of that kind of work, which is, you know, probably encompasses PhD students as well as masters and undergraduate students. And I do think that perhaps home PGR students have kind of, you know, perhaps not benefited from quite the same attention. So maybe that's one of the reasons for the differences there. But I think it is really nice to see about kind of, you know, international students feeling they belong, because obviously there have been, you know, some perhaps less positive messages coming in terms of, you know, kind of our broader migration policy in this country. And I would say also the academic literature gives lots of examples of how international students can feel very isolated and kind of, you know, not feel a great sense of belonging in institutions. So I think that's, you know, that is good progress for the UK sector there, I think.
Hi, it's Jim from the team here. AI hasn't just changed how students write essays. It's forced us to confront what learning actually means. As The Secret Life of Students returns for its 8th year, we're launching major new research revealing how students are really using AI, discussing what graduate ready means in 2026, and showcasing institutions already reimagining assessment for authentic learning at scale. Taking a step beyond what has felt like, for many, a moment of crisis, we're looking at it as a chance for creativity and a chance to reimagine what higher education is actually for, to strip away assessments that measure memorization rather than meaning making, and to design learning experiences that develop capabilities no algorithm can replicate. At the event, you'll explore how AI can enhance rather than replace human learning, what that means for everyone, with a new government white paper reshaping the landscape from oracy initiatives to work-based learning at scale. The Secret Life of Students is the event you need. With institutions under pressure to demonstrate genuine learning gain, the timing couldn't be sharper. This is the essential gathering for anyone working on student experience, teaching practice, or education policy, where you'll get evidence, not platitudes, practical strategies, not theoretical debates, and a vision of higher education that's more human, not less. That's The Secret Life of Students, learning to be human in an age of AI, March 2026. Tickets are available now. Book on wonky.com/events.
Right, now finally this week, universities and the high street. James, Jess Lister's been on the site this week arguing that universities have a responsibility for running vape shops.
So I thought this was a really interesting blog, and thanks to Jess at Public First for penning it for Wonky. The kind of standout message was when people are asked about issues in their local area, high street shop closures rank as the second most significant issue, second only to potholes. So Jim, I'm glad we've decided to focus the conversation on the impact of universities on high streets rather than on potholes. Let's not get universities dragged into solving that wicked problem. But more seriously, I mean, I took this as an invite into the broader question of how we, and the responsibility we have to demonstrate the real value of higher education to individuals, to families and communities, and how we continue to make the case that brilliant higher education doesn't just empower and transform people's opportunities, but it also gives them the ability to give back. And if it's okay, I'll just give an example, because I looked this up for us. So 3,500 students were accepted into nursing degrees in Scotland in 2024. Within 12 weeks of joining, most of those students will be out on placement, learning in the workplace as well as contributing in all sorts of different health and social care settings. 3 years in higher education for most of them will lead to a multi-decade career delivering truly transformative health and social care services for some of the most disadvantaged individuals in our societies. So, you know, yes, absolutely, universities need to have a role in regional regeneration. We need to recognise that matters to people in our communities. But we should also tell the story of the really big impact that we're really proud to bring to the table as a higher education institution.
You say that, though, about potholes, James, right? I swear to God, this is true. 18 months ago, I was at a case competition in Enschede in the Netherlands that was being run by 20 universities. And there were four student teams that were working out how to fix the wicked problem of potholes.
Yeah, I mean, it clearly, and no doubt somewhere in our brilliant university system, someone is looking at the question of how we get more resilience in our road infrastructure. I mean, I do recall at one point in my time at Robert Gordon University, we had a connectivity issue in one of our buildings. And the reason for that was because we had a pothole in the road and that was causing some issue with the Janet network. So they matter, right? But I think the key is that we don't just limit ourselves to some of the kind of hot button issues, but we also tell the story of the really big impacts, like all of those thousands of people who are going out into our health and social workforce. And we should be proud as much of them as we are of the staff who play really critical roles in getting them ready for their future careers.
Rachel, I often tell this story. A couple of summers ago, staying in Plymouth over the summer, and I'm above retail, right, in some space that was clearly used to be a stock room, but now is student accommodation. And I ventured outside in the early evening, and there was nowhere to go other than McDonald's or I think, you know, the German kebab company. And I ended up going back to my room and reading the Plymouth City Plan. And students were positioned as economic contributors, but not as citizens. That's part of the problem, isn't it?
I mean, I think, you know, we're seeing increasing numbers of students choosing to stay at home or commute to their local university. So I think these dynamics are changing quite a lot. And there are many students, you know, who have lived in the place where they're studying for a very long time and have, you know, important roots and close feelings to that. So I think, again, that's a kind of a complexity there. I mean, I think, you know, I would say that kind of, you know, when students are studying, even if they have moved away from home, you know, you can be a kind of, you know, you can have citizen feelings, you can feel close allegiances to places, even if you're not there all the time. And I think many students do that. And I think universities have also kind of, you know, taken quite important steps to kind of, you know, the article talks about the importance of kind of blurring the boundaries between campus and community. And I do think that's work that's been going on for quite a long time. As well as the kind of things that James was talking about, you know, there are kind of, you know, much more localized initiatives to kind of, you know, get local communities onto campus and to ensure that kind of, you know, students kind of behave well when they're kind of venturing from the campus into town. Near where I live, there are lots of signs around the university encouraging students to kind of be quiet if they're moving around late at night. So yeah, I mean, I do think, you know, kind of students can often feel a lot of attachment to the places where they're studying, even if they're not there all the year round. And I think, you know, that's kind of been helped by lots of activities that have been taken over the kind of past decade to kind of improve community campus relationships by getting communities onto campus to use university facilities, as well as movement the other way around too.
Look, final thing, Jimbo, Pride in Place was a big thing at Labour Party conference, right? This new Pride in Place strategy. There's a huge amount of money going into Pride in Place. And when I was reading the kind of prospectus, almost every kind of voluntary and community and government and quasi-government and public and quasi-public organisation other than universities were mentioned as players in that strategy. What, you know, what is going wrong such that Jess is having to write this blog?
Jim, have you ever heard of a little place called Darlington? Are you familiar with it?
No idea. Tell me, please do tell me more.
Seventh fastest growing economy in the entire country. Access to seven government departments, 2 hours from London, 2 hours from Edinburgh, on the doorstep of York, Durham, Newcastle. The greatest town that has ever invented. Home of the steam locomotion. The single biggest conversation, if I go home, is about the local House of Fraser closing down and it gutting the high street. There is no not a single bigger thing that any university could do to improve their access, to have access to an outstanding school and outstanding college in many parts of Edpie postcodes in Darlington, to improve their civic impact, to improve their image, and to strengthen their overall perception than somebody moving into that House of Fraser and running a shop, a university site out of it. So, if Teesside, University of York, Newcastle, Northumbria, Durham, York St. John, or Leeds are listening, and you want to improve your civic impact, please take over the House of Fraser.
Do a Gloucester. Take over Debenhams.
Take over Debenhams. That is my call to you.
Well, fascinating stuff. That's about it for this week. Remember to go in deep on anything we've discussed today. You'll find links in the show notes on wonky.com. Don't forget to subscribe. Just search for The Wonky Show wherever you get your podcasts. And if you want to get ahead of everything going on in UKHE, just click subscriptions on the site to find out more. So huge thanks to Rachel, James, Michael, Salmon for making it all happen. We'll be back next week. Mark will be here. Until then, stay wonky.